Welcome to Island Watch, where each episode we explore an island by watching a TV show or a movie. Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale. Hi, I'm Gemma Voss.
And I'm Dave Zarg. And yes, welcome to Island Watch, the podcast that transports you to islands all over the world. If you're up for a getaway, you've come to the right place. This week, the good ship Island Watch visits the mystical isle of Cape Breton via the movie New Waterford Girl. All aboard! So here we are, sailing in the Atlantic Ocean, along the eastern coast of Canada, heading for Cape Breton Island. We're going to take some time to get acquainted with the island first, and then we'll dive into the movie.
Cape Breton is off the north coast of mainland Nova Scotia. It's about 110 kilometers southwest of Newfoundland, which we visited in season one of Island Watch.
Cape Breton is rugged and dramatic. The land rises from the southern lowlands to the crest of Cape North and the Highlands, which are the highest point of land in the Canadian Atlantic Islands.
The island is just over 10,000 square kilometers, comparable in size to Lebanon, or the Gambia, or the Bahamas. At Cape Breton's heart is Bradore, one of the largest saltwater lakes on Earth.
The first people on the island were the Mi'kmaq, who have been living in the Maritimes and northeastern U.S. states for about 10,000 years.
In their oral traditions, a Mi'kmaq spiritual guide predicted that people with blue eyes would appear from the east and cause disruption for the Mi'kmaq. Another story passed down was of a woman who had a vision of an island with tall trees floating toward the Mi'kmaq nation, and on this floating island were living beings.
Because of this foresight, the Mi'kmaq weren't surprised when explorers came sailing in on tall ships around 1500. They welcomed the newcomers from the east and got to business setting up trade with them. John Cabot sighted the island in 1497 and Jacques Cartier in 1534. The French claimed the island as part of Acadia, but didn't do much with it, just some fur trading and fishing.
But after losing mainland Acadia and Newfoundland to the British in the Treaty of Utrecht in 1713, the French decided to make the most of Cape Breton as they still retained it. They renamed it Île Royale, and they started construction on a fortified town which became the Fortress of Louisbourg.
The importance of Louisbourg to Canadian history may not be as clear in our historical memory. So you might be surprised to find out when you visit there that it was pivotal in the Anglo-French War for Supremacy in North America. Had things gone differently for the French in 1758, they might now be in control of North America. You're going to have to visit the fortress, a fascinating place right on the island's edge, to get the story of the two major military sieges and why the how of things turned out as they did. Or just check out links on our website to find out more.
By 1763, it was all over. France ceded Cape Breton to the British.
In the mid-1780s, 30,000 Loyalist refugees from the American Revolutionary War poured into what is now the Maritimes, swamping the existing population. The British forced the Mi'kmaq population into reserves and established the colonies of New Brunswick and Cape Breton in order to administer the large population of settlers.
So let's narrow in our focus a bit more to the immediate surroundings of today's visit, and we're going to talk about Sydney. Sydney is a city on Cape Breton's east coast, just a 20-kilometer drive away from New Waterford, which is the setting of today's movie.
Sydney is also home to the world's largest fiddle, a solid steel 18-meter monument to the island's musicality. If you've ever come in on a cruise ship, it's one of the first things you'll see when you step onto land.
The Loyalists made Sydney their capital, and it stayed that way until the colony of Cape Breton merged with Nova Scotia in 1820, and the capital moved to Halifax, which is still the provincial capital today.
Next to arrive were the Scots, who soon outnumbered the Loyalists, as 50,000 arrived from the Scottish Highlands and the Hebrides between 1770 and 1840, during the Highland Clearances.
It's said the first Scottish settler spent his first winter on the island with just his overturned boat for shelter. These Gaelic-speaking peoples occupied most of the farmable land on the coast and around the lake we mentioned, Bradoor. Together with a few hundred returning Acadians, they made up most of the island's population, and they were mostly rural dwellers who were fisher folk.
The industrialization of the island began with the British mining coal in the early 1700s. The Sydney coalfield in the southeastern part of the island was the main driver of the island's economy in the 19th and 20th centuries. In fact, they were the largest private employers in Canada until after World War II.
So we come to the 1920s, which was a time of unrest in Cape Breton. William Davis was a coal miner living in New Waterford, Nova Scotia, the very same town of today's movie title. In 1925, he was working at a mine in New Waterford, and he and his wife Myrtle were raising 9 kids, with another on the way.
A strike that began in March 1925, with 12,000 striking miners, escalated until the morning of June 11th, when company police fired over 300 shots at a crowd of several thousand strikers, injuring many.
One of the officers deliberately shot William Davis in the heart, and he was dead in minutes. The police fell back. Miners flooded into the mining facilities throughout the Sydney coalfield. Provincial police and close to 2,000 soldiers from the Canadian Army were called in.
That was the second largest military deployment for an internal conflict in Canadian history after the Northwest Rebellion of 1885.
So William Davis's funeral was held 3 days later. 5,000 people attended. The police officer who shot Davis was spirited away to Boston for his protection and was never reprimanded, as the Crown Prosecutor agreed with the defense that no one man should be singled out, as many police officers were involved that day.
Eventually, the company accepted government intervention and settled the strike, giving up attempts to break the union. Cape Breton did not forget. The next year, June 11, 1926, was the first Davis Day, where, in William's memory, many miners refused to work. Fast forward to 2008, a private members' bill was passed in the Nova Scotia legislature to officially designate June 11th as William Davis Miners' Memorial Day.
In 1965, the company operating the Sydney coalfield announced that its mines had only 15 years of production remaining. It was the official kickoff to a slow and torturous loss of the industry on which so many had depended on for so long for their livelihood. It's also at the root of the depressed state of affairs that the people of New Waterford Girl are enduring.
The music Cape Breton is best known for is inextricably linked with the migration there. When people forced out of Scotland during the Highland Clearances arrived on the island, they brought their music with them. The fiddle and bagpipes have been the main instruments.
Actually, rumor has it that there are more fiddlers per capita on Cape Breton than anywhere else in the world.
Also, according to Wikipedia, quote, Cape Breton playing is highly accented, characterized by driven up bowing. The tunes of other music origins, such as Irish or French Canadian, sound quite different when performed by Cape Breton players. The strong downbeat pulse is driven by the fiddler's heel into the floor, unquote.
Okay, I don't know that I understood much of that, Dave, but I do know that there is some mighty fine fiddling, and it makes you want to move. Here's an example from New Waterford Girl. Juno Award winner Ashley McIsaac playing the town fiddler at the town pub Mooney and Lou visit. Samples of Ashley's life. He opened for the famed Irish group The Chieftains on a U.S. tour. He appeared on Conan O'Brien's show, and a particularly enthusiastic high kick answered the age-old kilt question, but post-production handled it.
Ashley's cousin, Natalie McMaster, started playing the fiddle at age 9 and released her first album at age 16. She has issued a string of albums since, including one with her uncle, Buddy McMaster, who was considered the foremost fiddler in the province.
She's so accomplished. And there's many groups also from the island. There's the Barra McNeils. They're a set of siblings from Sydney Mines who've been performing together for more than 30 years. And they play not just fiddles, but also guitar, banjo, mandolin, Celtic harp, the bowron, accordion, and tin whistle to produce roots and traditional music.
There's the Rankin family, a family of 12 siblings, many of whom have played in the group in the past several decades. The older siblings started playing out at Cayley's in the 1970s.
Okay, wait. By Cayley, you mean people putting on a Celtic music performance at a pub or a hall? That kind of Cayley?
Yes, that's right. And some of the siblings went on to record several albums and became quite famous.
And we mustn't forget the pride and joy of the town of Big Pond, Rita McNeil, who persisted for years to build her music career before she finally hit it big with songs like Working Man and Flying on Your Own in the late 1980s.
It's fair to say that music is central to life on Cape Breton Island.
Look, there's just so much going on Cape Breton, from an outsider point of view anyway. It's hard to imagine wanting to leave. We are barely even touching the surface. There's rich history, the natural beauty, like we haven't even talked about the National Park, the Cabot Trail. There's so much to see. There's the unique mix of cultures, including Mi'kmaq, Celtic, Acadian, other newcomers. So if you can get there and hike around that Cabot Trail or visit any number of gorgeous coves and mountains, then don't let anything other than COVID stop you. The people are just as memorable as the scenery. Popcorn is great with a show, but sometimes I want to connect the snacks to the movie just that much more, so I've searched high and low to find the perfect munchies meant exactly for the show we're watching right now, New Waterford Girl. We've gathered together recipes and other information for the foods featured in the show, and now we are sharing our picnic picks with you so you can get every cheeky bit out of New Waterford Girl.
Okay. I'll just make you a bologna sandwich.
Okay.
On squishy white bread with cheese glue.
Great.
With petroleum salad dressing.
Just head to our website, islandwatchpodcast.com, for our picnic picks.
And now, on to the show. We're pulling ashore at the town of New Waterford, Nova Scotia, for the movie New Waterford Girl.
It's the late 1970s, and 15-year-old Mooney Potty feels out of place in this small town on the shore of Cape Breton. She dreams of escape. Her teacher, who has an inappropriate crush on her, has high hopes for her, and he manages to get her a scholarship to a school in New York City. But Mooney's parents won't let her go.
Another influence in Mooney's life is Lou, the new girl in town. Lou has just moved from the Bronx to the island with her mum. Lou seems like she could fit in anywhere, but her mom, played by Kathy Moriarty, so entertaining, her mom is struggling and clearly not too happy about the turn of events that led them to have to move to New Waterford.
And Mooney, desperate to get off the island, hatches an escape plan.
Okay, so maybe this sounds like the type of movie you already know the plot to, but it has more than the typical dissatisfied teenager goings on. It's a portrait of Mooney, her family, and the town. And really, it's universal. I mean, remember that feeling in high school when you're wondering how far you can push things and how far you'll get in this world? How's the sailing today? If you're enjoying our podcast, we'd love you to give us a hand by rating and reviewing Island Watch on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
And be sure to tell your friends about Island Watch. Leanne Balaban plays Mooney. New Waterford Girl was her film debut. She was just 19 when it was released, and in fact, she had not originally planned to go into acting, but one of the producers knew her and suggested that Leanne audition for the film. Her performance was well received. She was recognized at the Toronto International Film Festival with a special jury citation. Now, she's gone on to make several Canadian and Hollywood movies, including Definitely Maybe with Ryan Reynolds and the independent drama 1 Week with Joshua Jackson. And we've seen her before here on Island Watch when we viewed The Grand Seduction.
Leanne's character Mooney could not have a better name. Mooney literally moons about. She's this pale-skinned presence in a giant cable-knit black turtleneck. I mean, she is an artist, so she's engaging in her art. She is talented, and her teacher, played by Andrew McCarthy, is actively trying to get opportunities for her.
Is that the same Andrew McCarthy who was in St. Elmo's Fire and Pretty in Pink?
One and the same. So Mooney is the kid who sees and processes everything, but in her own singular way. Her family is convinced that she's touched in the head, as they used to say, and that she needs nerve pills. Even the new girl in town calls her drama queen, but that girl Lou also treats Mooney like a normal human being, because there is nothing wrong with her.
Lou is played by Tara Spencer Nairn, a new Waterford girl was her first film. Tara grew up in British Columbia and graduated from the Vancouver Film School. She has guest starred on numerous Canadian shows and appeared in about 10 films. She's best known for her role as Constable Karen Pelly in all 6 seasons of Corner Gas, a role she has reprised in Corner Gas the Movie and Corner Gas Animated.
Lou and Mooney are two very different characters, but in a way neither of them are afraid of a good throwdown, and there's nearly an instant bond with the two of them. So just listen in as Mooney sees her new neighbor driving up and getting out at the house across the driveway.
So you gonna give me the grand tour?
Okay.
My house, your house. There's the shore, the mine, the main drag. Hospital, tavern, church, church, rink, school, train station, road to Sydney.
Lou's signature wardrobe is a shiny red faux leather knee-length coat, and it has the kind of flash and swagger that suits her to a T. And it means she's meant to take the lead on a lot of the adventures, while Mooney is more of the counselor with local wisdom.
So, you go rowing much?
Rowing?
Yeah.
Yeah, all the time. It's what we all do, you know. Row, fish, jig, collect pogies.
Okay, it just sounds nice to me, okay?
Nicholas Campbell, who plays Mooney's dad. He's one of those actors you see all over the place. You'll definitely recognize his face. He's been in shows like Black Mirror, Murdoch Mysteries. He was on Republic of Doyle as Martin Poole. Or my favorite, he played the lead role as the coroner in Da Vinci's Inquest.
As father to Mooney, his character, Francis Potty, is gruff and practical, roughened by tough times, but no less loving for it. Just some of that good old, shoulder-shrugging dad cluelessness that fathers of the time were known for.
And when he's pushed to his limit, he likes to make chocolate cake.
Something wrong with someone making a cake?
No, Dad.
Right.
And then there's Mary Walsh. Mary Walsh. We meet again. You may remember her from The Grand Seduction. In New Waterford Girl, she plays Mom, and Mom has the amazing name of Cookie Potty. It's an amazing name. Cookie is trying to do her best by Mooney, but like her husband, Cookie is of a very practical bent. I mean, one of the gifts she gives Mooney is a nurse's uniform. For real, not a costume. She doesn't really get Mooney, though their connection is having some rough patches. With Mooney's teenagehood, Cookie really loves her daughter for who she is. And that says a lot, because Mooney is giving Cookie lots of reasons to crumble.
Mooney's parents are flummoxed that two practical folks have produced such a dreamy and passionate offspring. Mooney comes home with news about a potential scholarship to New York City. The family discuss it. Mooney's in the tub with her mom Cookie sitting in the bathroom, while Francis and Mooney's little brother chime in from outside the bathroom door.
It's an arts high school. In Manhattan, New York.
In the States.
It's paid for. It's supervised.
You can't even be normal in a town this size.
I'm normal.
Francis, I think we better make a trip to the doctor.
Doctor? Listen to me. Now you listen to me. We all had dreams, you know. All of us. What do you think? We just woke up one morning and there's 5 kids there?
So, Gemma, how has this movie aged? It was made in 1999, but it's set in the 1970s.
I think it actually has aged pretty well. I know if it were written today, one major difference in the script would be I don't think they would portray her teacher, Andrew McCarthy, as being in love with her.
You're right. That part hasn't really aged well.
But it's not a relationship at all. I mean, he has, like you said, an inappropriate crush on her. She just couldn't be less interested. I gotta say, you know, because Mom Cookie is Mary Walsh, Mary Walsh had a character in her skit days.
Princess Marg, kind of a Xena warrior princess type of character.
Princess Marg, uh-huh, right? And she took care of business all over the place. And this movie is one of those places. So it gets handled just in a 1999, 1970s kind of way, not a 2020 kind of way.
But I think what is still universal and timeless about the movie is the wishes and hopes and dreams of a teenager who's beginning to realize that their community is kind of small and enclosing and wants to get out there and experience something of the wider world.
Yeah, just what a lot of teenagers go through, a normal process. I think overall, A New Waterford Girl, it shows people fighting for what they believe in and what they love. And that struggle comes in as many forms as there are characters.
It's interesting to see all of this play out within the constrictions of the time and place of New Waterford, Nova Scotia, on Cape Breton Island in the late 1970s.
Yeah, it's a universal story, but what makes it unique are exactly those constrictions.
It's time for ratings. Here at Island Watch, we give each watch two different ratings. First, our island rating, which answers the question, how much of an island feel do we get from this show?
The hook for me was how Mooney's relationship to the island changed as she grew. Early on, there's a moment where the events of the day, they're just too much for Mooney, and she slinks out of the community gathering to get some air. And she's leaning against the side of the house. She's looking out across the bay. And there's no dialogue at all, but you just see from her body language and her face, she does not have the contentment of someone happy with where they are. She's got a kind of narrow-eyed loathing of where she is. If she could summon what she needed to build a boat, she would do it right then and there and sail herself off and away in that instant. But the shore becomes a place where Mooney is going to make most of her important decisions about her life. My favorite scene it's very brief. It's just a scene, she's lying on her back in the yard, and the yard is enclosed by a weathered fence. She's watching the laundry flip in the wind. It's super gusty. And beyond the laundry and the fence is the ocean. It's right there. And it's this moody, brooding, just like mesmerizing sky. It's so unique, that framing of the ocean, and more memorable because of it. And in the softness of her expression, you can read what she's going through. I just thought that was a very beautiful moment in the movie.
So what is your island rating, Gemma?
Well, there's nothing artificial. Like, there's no putting lipstick on this thing. It's just the raw, rugged, unglamorized coastline of southeast Cape Breton. And I could look at that all day. So I get to feel the island through Mooney's eyes, from her longing to leave to her awakening to how amazing the people in the place are. It all grows through shots of the island. So I give this movie 4 out of 5 toes in the sand.
It's an authentic, straightforward view of life on the island. We see the stark beauty of the island and the resilience of the people. My toes are in the sand. 4 out of 5.
We also give a star rating, so would you recommend this movie to a friend? Dave, what's your score for New Waterford Girl?
It's an entertaining slice-of-life film. I enjoyed spending some time with these characters, so I'm going to give it a 3.5 out of 5.
There are no bells or whistles here. It's good acting, good script, and the setting is captivating. I think it's better than most things you'll find streaming right now. And I don't know about you, But these days, I'm looking for shows that are on the non-icky side of life. So this show kind of has, I guess maybe because it's set in the 70s, but it kind of has like a nostalgic feeling to it. Sort of like you're gathered around and you're describing a friend or family member and like, hey, remember when they were a kid and they did this? And I just feel better after watching it. And not in a saccharine way. You're not going to feel like you got smeared with a layer of icing. It's just a good show. So same as you, 3.5 out of 5. Time for Find the Island. With so many islands in the world, we're traveling virtually and discovering islands that are new to us. Here's how to play. One of us gives a series of clues and the other tries to work out what island it is. Best of all, you can play along at home. Today, it's Dave's turn to highlight an island.
This island is one of those near yet far away places. Not necessarily near to you and me. What I mean is this. The island's population is only 4,000 people, yet it is located just 30 kilometers from one of the largest metropolises in the world.
Is this a Disney island? I don't know. I'm just making a random guess.
No. Not as far as I know.
Okay. More clues, please.
Okay. In the one incorporated city on the island, where 90% of the people live, motorized transportation is quite restricted. Only very small cars, which are referred to as autoettes, are permitted. And there's a strict limit on issuing permits, so golf carts are the most common.
Well, I wanted you to say clown cars are the most common, because that way it would also be efficient public transport.
They might fit the definition of autoettes.
You're really sure this is not an amusement park on an island?
It's not an amusement park. The island has been occupied by humans since about 7,000 BCE. The first European to set foot on the island was a Spaniard in 1542, who claimed it for Spain. And then, of course, things didn't go well for the indigenous population after that. Many died of diseases that white people brought, and by the 1830s, all the remaining indigenous population had been moved to the mainland.
This is ringing bells. It sounds something like... what was that thing that we did a few weeks ago, the woman who was alone on the island? So I'm feeling like this is off the North American coast, and I feel like California or Mexico is nearby, mainland-wise.
You're getting warm, let's say that, because the climate of this island is classed as a warm summer Mediterranean climate, though it's nowhere near the Mediterranean.
I want to go to there.
Yes. This and its proximity to a large city in pre-COVID times would bring 1 million visitors a year to the island.
Okay. I feel like I'm in the right area, but I can't.
Okay. The island is one of a group of 8 islands, and the archipelago is called the Channel Islands, but it's not the group that contains Jersey or Guernsey.
Okay. Yeah. Because I thought, how did I get that far off? I probably should, but I don't know.
It's Santa Catalina Island. Now, Santa Catalina is often just shortened to Catalina. It's just off the coast of Los Angeles. In fact, it's part of Los Angeles County. It's one of the Channel Islands of California. And one of its neighbors is San Nicolas, the island that we referred to a couple of episodes ago, where the lone woman of San Nicolas had survived on the island.
Okay, so they are neighbors. Well, that makes sense.
Now, this island, Catalina, is about 195 square kilometers in size. It's the third largest of the Channel Islands, and it's the most populous. Because it's close to the mainland, lots of people usually visit. There are 2 ferry services, and cruise ships frequently stop by at the main settlement, which is called Avalon.
Avalon. Well, that's a beautiful name. I love the idea of this island being car-free, but in the land of the free, how exactly do they manage that?
Well, I think it's largely because of environmental considerations. And the autoettes that I mentioned, only small cars can be approved, like about the size of a Mini. But because it's so restricted, that means a waiting list that could take up to 14 years to get approval to bring a car to the island. So most residents use golf carts or bicycles. And that means for visitors, the ferry service, you can't bring your car. So tourists can hire a taxi or they rent a golf cart or a bicycle.
Well, Cape Breton and Catalina Island, what a trip. We are now headed back on board and setting sail for another port. And we've got a few clues for you to ponder what our next destination is going to be.
The islands we're visiting next time are part of Australia's Northern Territory, and they're located about 80 kilometers north of the city of Darwin.
The islands are named for the Aboriginal people who live there.
You think you know Australian rules football? Then this is the place to visit. Out of 2,300 residents, 400 are regular players, and the islands also hold the greatest concentration of football champions per capita.
That sounds like a bunch of fit folk. Okay, to see if you've guessed the island correctly, head to our website at islandwatchpodcast.com. Bonus, you'll also see what show we're going to use to travel there.
Tune in next time for another great Island Watch adventure.
In the meantime, tell your friends about us. Follow us at Island Watch Cast on Twitter. Our email address is islandwatchpodcast@gmail.com.
And visit our website at islandwatchpodcast.com for show notes and more, like the answer to the big question, where does the good ship Island Watch sail to next? Fair winds and calm seas. This has been a production of Phosphine League.
Phosphine League.
Phosphine League.
Phosphine League. Phosphine League.